Thank you, everybody, for choosing to attend our October 2023 State of the Economy call. I'm going to be very short with my intro here so we can just get into it. There's been a lot of fun things happening in the economy and in the world that I know everybody wants to hear Gene talk about. Just as a reminder and some housekeeping, there is a chat function at the bottom that is available for questions should any questions arise during Gene's meeting. Go ahead and click on that chat button and you can submit a question. Anything you submit will only be visible to me and our team here, won't be visible to everybody else. Don't feel like you need to be worried about other people seeing your questions. If we don't get to all the questions by the end, Gene will send out a follow-up communication and make sure everybody's questions are answered to the extent that our crystal ball will allow us to answer them. But with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Gene. And thank you so much, Gene, for being here.
Great. Thank you, Michael. And we'll dive right in because I am notorious for talking too long, so I don't want to waste any time. I will share the presentation with you and we will get started. So welcome, everybody. I always appreciate everybody's participation. It always seems like these calls are very timely with events in the market, and it certainly was a difficult September. As I was preparing for this call last week, I thought I was going to have to address the implications of a government shutdown. Thankfully, that didn't happen. But I think what we're learning in the aftermath is that the drama in Washington is going to continue, and it's going to continue to add uncertainty for consumers, for investors, and for the markets as we move forward, particularly as we head into an election year. But we don't have to talk about a shutdown, at least for today. So I will move on to this first slide really serves as a little bit of an overview of our outlook for the rest of the year and into next year, and also some of the key themes that I'm going to try to highlight today. There hasn't been a significant change in our basic outlook. We're still talking about slowing economic growth, the potential for a mild recession. I think just the timing of that piece has shifted a little bit, and it still seems to be shifting. The Fed is nearing the end of their tightening cycle, at least as it relates to rates. And we do believe that they will keep rates higher for longer. And you're going to hear me use that higher for longer phrase probably quite a bit as we go through our slides today. And I think the other, outlook piece is the uncertainty, rising investor uncertainty, higher market volatility that's driven by external events. It's driven by higher interest rates and any number of themes. So we'll go through some of these things. The economy has surprised on the upside so far the last few quarters, but we do think we will see slowing into the end of the year. Inflation is improving, but it's still too high. And there is some potential for inflation to either not fall from here or possibly reaccelerate a little bit, and we'll talk about that. The labor market, really the health of the consumer and the labor market are going to be the keys to whether we continue to see moderate economic growth or whether we have a mild recession. And so we'll talk about all these things as we go through all of these slides. Higher interest rates, particularly in the last month, we've seen a significant increase in interest rates on the long end of the curve. They're certainly having an impact on some interest rate sectors of the economy, like housing, but also it's having an impact in the equity market, particularly on interest rate sensitive and defensive sectors of the market. And we'll discuss that. And then we've had a little bit of a shift in how we're viewing our fixed income allocation. And then we'll end talking a little bit about our income equity strategy and some changes that we started making there at the end of the third quarter. So we'll start off looking at the inflation environment on page three. So what you've got here is the Consumer Price Index, or CPI. The green bars are the month over month change, and the gray line is the year over year change. So for most of 2021 and 2022, we saw a steady increase in consumer prices, and we peaked in June of 2022. That was the highest month over month change at 1.2%, and it was also the peak of the year over year change at 9.1%. That early inflationary period was really driven by two things. One, energy prices. As the global economy was reopening, the demand for oil and energy was rising, and the supply of energy was not keeping pace. So we had an acceleration in prices. The second piece, if you remember, we've talked about, was the price of goods. We had still had supply chain disruptions going on, and demand for goods was very strong, but the ability for manufacturers and companies to get those goods to market was strained. So we saw things like auto prices, particularly used car prices, more than double during that time period. So when you go past that peak of June of 2022, and I'll point out, because people have asked, July of 2022, that is correct. Inflation was actually flat, no change month over month. But to that right-hand side of June of 2022, we've seen much more moderate month over month change in inflation, and therefore the year over year numbers coming down. Where we're seeing inflationary pressures today is not from goods prices. That's actually been helping to bring inflation down. And actually, energy up until very recently has been pulling inflation down rather than contributing to it. So where we're really seeing it is in shelter costs, so rents and rental equivalents. And those, you know, it took them a long time to really impact CPI on the way up, and it takes a little longer for it to come out. But the data that we're seeing in the market is that rental prices are starting to come down. So we think that that rental pressure will continue to ease as we move forward. Where we're really concerned today, well, there's two things. The other place where inflationary pressures are coming from is from the transportation services area. And that's things like auto insurance, car rental costs, auto repair costs. Those are continuing to contribute to these month over month changes in inflation. But where we're really focused right now is in two areas. And one is energy. It had been deflationary, but production cuts from OPEC have really widened the gap between supply and demand for oil, and that's pushed prices up more recently. We have an OPEC Plus meeting today. I don't know if they'll keep production at current levels. It's possible they may cut production even further, which could lead to higher oil prices over the near term. And really, you know, we talk about energy prices as being very volatile on a month-to-month basis. But as it impacts overall inflation, it's if prices stay higher for longer to the point where it impacts costs in a business, particularly businesses that have high transportation costs. The longer energy prices are elevated, the more likely they are to have to raise prices to offset that. So the short-term volatility most companies can work through, it's the longer-term impact. So we're keeping our eye on the energy market and energy prices to make sure that we continue to see improvement in inflation. The other area that could impact consumer prices is wages. And wages, you know, they're not a direct component of the CPI, but they certainly contribute to increases in prices. And on page four, where we are looking at the change in consumer prices or CPI relative to the change in average hourly earnings. And we did this on a cumulative basis rather than month to month or year over year. And that was really for two reasons. One is just looking at the cumulative change, it kind of puts in context what we've been through over the last 3 years. It's a little easy to focus on the current year over year change where CPI is up 3.7% year over year, but forget the long-term impact. So, you know, since the end of 2019, consumer prices are up just over 18% overall. During that time, wages have moved not always perfectly in line with consumer prices, but relatively in line with them. This is showing them up a little bit more than consumer prices, but it's really the relationship of the two moving together that we focus on. If you think about a company, wages and labor costs are, for most companies, particularly service-related companies, are their greatest cost. So if wages are rising, at some point, a company has a choice to either raise their prices on their goods and services to offset the higher cost of wages, or they can accept a lower level of profit. So that's why wages are such an important point. And if wages continue to rise or reaccelerate, our concern is that it could feed into higher consumer prices going forward. As we'll talk about over the next couple of pages, you know, with wages being so important, you know, we do have a very strong labor market. And we're in a situation today where it seems that job holders and employees have the upper hand with their companies in the ability to ask for and get concessions. So that's one of the reasons we're very much watching this. Wages and prices that we see here can help us look at the consumer's ability to spend. But on the next page, we have consumer confidence, which really gets to their willingness to spend. If you don't feel good about the future, it doesn't really matter whether your wages are rising or falling, or if you have savings, you're probably not going to spend. So on the left-hand side of the page here, we have the Consumer Confidence Index. And on the right-hand side of the page, these are the two primary components that make up that Consumer Confidence Index. So the green line is the present situation, and that's basically how do you feel today? And the gray line is your expectations for the future. And that's generally thought of as, you know, the next 6 months or so. So going back to the overall index on the left, consumer confidence has improved from the pandemic era lows, but we're certainly not back to pre-pandemic levels. And it's bounced around a little bit in there. Probably, you know, we're seeing that higher prices are weighing on the consumer, but the strong labor market is offsetting some of that. And we are seeing that, you know, a reasonable level of confidence that is driving consumer spending today, and particularly on services, travel, leisure, and entertainment type activities. You know, the uncertainty about inflation has probably contributed to what we're seeing in the present situation part of the index, which has really been moving sideways for quite a while. So the future expectation part of it, we saw a little bit of a recovery and now it's turned over a bit. It's a little bit more volatile, but I think the recent decline in the equity market and the increase in rates that we've seen is probably weighing on consumer sentiment even more. So putting this all together, it's, you know, what we would say is that the consumer is not overly optimistic. They're not overly pessimistic. So good, but not great. And this could still support consumer spending going forward, but probably not at the levels that we've seen in the past several quarters, but not a falling off of consumer spending completely. One of the things that I mentioned that's really helping to keep consumer confidence up is the labor market, which we'll talk about starting on page 6. So on the left-hand side of the page, you have the unemployment rate. And on the right-hand side of the page is the labor force participation rate. So there have been some cracks in the labor market of late, but overall it remains very healthy. We've seen a marginal rise in the unemployment rate in the last couple of months from about 3.4% to 3.7% currently. If you look at payroll data, which is a different survey from this that measures the number of jobs added, we're still adding new jobs every month, but the pace of job addition is slower than it was. So for the last 3 months, we've averaged about 150,000 new jobs per month. And if you look at the first 6 months of the year, we averaged about 235,000 new jobs per month. But the good news on the right-hand side of the page with the labor market participation rate is that that is continuing to improve. So the labor force includes people who are currently working as well as people who are actively seeking jobs. So growth in the labor market is a sign that people think that there's an opportunity out there for them to be employed. And the other thing that we're seeing in the labor force participation rate is where we're adding people back into the labor force is in that prime age market, which is defined as 25 to 55. So most of the gain we've seen, there's about 3 million more people in the labor market today than there was in February of 2020. And the vast majority of those are in that 25 to 55 year range. And the remaining is coming from 16 to 24. So we are seeing people that are expected to stay in the labor market coming back into the labor market. If you look at the over 55, it's about where it was at the start of the pandemic. So people who retired early during the pandemic, some of them have come back, but we're not really getting an acceleration there. On page 7, I think is an even more interesting way to look at the strength of the labor market. And this data comes from the JOLTS report, which stands for Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. JOLTS is a much better way to say it. And we've looked at JOLTS data before on overall jobs, but this is two particular segments of that report that I think are very interesting for describing the labor market today. So on the left-hand side of the page, you have the total number of quits. So this is the number of people that voluntarily choose to leave their job every month. I only have the data here showing from 2020 on, but the average that you see there goes back to 2000. So it is a long-term average. So on average, about 2 million people choose to leave their job every month. And you can see the numbers are significantly above that and have been for quite some time. So right now, March of last year was kind of the peak, and at about 2.9 million people leaving their current job. We're down now to somewhere between 2.3 and 2.4 million. But the point being that you don't voluntarily leave your current job unless you feel relatively certain that you'll be able to get another job or you already have another job. So a high level of quits and above average level of quits tells us that employees feel good about the labor market today. On the right-hand side of the page, this data really looks more from a company perspective, and this is layoffs. So here, this is the number of people who are laid off monthly. And you can see the long-term average there is about 1.4 million people per month are laid off. Currently, we're right around a million people. So still below the long-term levels. And there's really two things going on here from the company side or the employer side. One, we still have about 9.6 million job openings across the country. So employers are focused on filling job openings. They're not laying people off. And the other thing is we've seen in business surveys that some employers, while they might like to cut costs on the labor side, they're really hesitant to lay off their existing workers for fear that they won't be able to rehire them. In some cases, it took a long time to find that quality employee, so they're concerned about the ability to bring them back, so they're not laying people off. But you put both of these together, the perspective from the employee and the employer, it's telling you that the labor market is quite healthy. And it's one of the reasons why we're a little concerned about wage pressures. It certainly feels like the employee has the upper hand in labor negotiations, and we've certainly had a flurry of labor issues over the last few months. You know, most Americans are not employed in union jobs, but they certainly get a lot of headlines. So we've had, you know, the Teamsters and UPS working on a labor deal with some pretty large concessions over the summer. We have the current UAW strike versus the auto workers. We're going to see a strike in the healthcare sector this week with Kaiser. And then we had strikes in Hollywood on writers and actors. So that strength that the employee has is one of the reasons we're a little concerned about wages going forward and the impact that that could have on consumer prices. So really the strength of the labor market, I think of it as a double-edged sword. It helps drive consumer spending. It helps keep the economy moving forward, but it has the potential to stoke some wage pressures, which could re-accelerate inflation or just keep inflation from falling back down to where the Fed would like to have it. We talked a little bit about higher interest rates and the impact that it's having primarily where we're seeing it is in the housing market. So on page 8, here you've got the existing home sales, total existing home sales. The green line is existing home sales on an annualized basis, and that's using the left-hand axis. And the gray line is new home sales, also annualized, and that's off of the right-hand axis. So, you know, I think when we spoke back in March, existing home sales had come down pretty dramatically and started to turn up a little bit. And we talked about whether that was a trend or just a near-term move. And it clearly looks like it was a near-term move because it's turned back over. Most of the housing market is existing sales. You'll notice that new home sales also trended down for quite a while and are coming up more recently. And there's a reason for that. Some of the larger home builders have been offering below market interest rates and other incentives to buyers in order to sell the properties that they currently have. So if somebody is needing a home, they have the option of buying an existing house at a mortgage, you know, north of 7.5%, or potentially buying a new home with a lot of builder incentives. And in some cases, we're seeing interest rates being offered by the builders below 5%. So that's what's driving that in the near term. But really, the other important part of putting both of these together is the higher rates are impacting the activity in housing, but it's not impacting prices. And that's because we still have a supply and demand imbalance. There's still more people looking to buy homes, even with higher rates, than there are homes available for sale. And that's helped to put a little bit of a floor on prices. Higher mortgage rates, stable prices, affordability is definitely a problem. And so we think the housing market will remain relatively weak, but we don't think that prices will decline significantly from here. The next page is an interesting look at that. When you talk about higher rates, we all tend to assume that everybody is paying a higher rate, but we're really not. Unless you choose to sell your home and buy a new home, you're paying the existing rate on your mortgage, which for a lot of us is quite attractive. So what you're seeing here on page 9 is the difference between the current market mortgage rate, 30-year mortgage rate, which is around 7.5 to 7.75, versus what the rate is of the average outstanding mortgages that we all hold. So currently, if you have an existing mortgage that you've had for several years, your interest rate is about 3.5% below what the current market rate is. So your debt hasn't changed, your debt servicing hasn't changed. And so it kind of has a twofold effect. Most consumer debt is mortgage debt. So that's helping, you know, that's one of the reasons why the consumer is doing okay, because the bulk of their consumer debt has not changed in interest rate. And the other thing is getting back to the supply problem in housing. This is a reason why we're not going to see much new supply come on the market, because unless you have to move, you probably don't want to sell your house and take out a new mortgage at a 3.5% or greater differential. So kind of putting all this together, the strong labor market, consumer confidence that's good but not great, inflation and still too high, slowing housing activity. The next page will really look at the impact on GDP. So we have seen this chart before. The green bars are quarterly GDP annualized. The green line is the long-term average, which is right at 2%. And then the gray bars are the estimates for GDP through the end of 2024 on a quarterly basis. These particular estimates come from Strategus Research Partners, who's somebody that we work with very closely, helps us on a lot of our macroeconomic data. So we're just using their estimates. You know, third quarter, we just completed the third quarter and growth was surprisingly stronger than expected. We'll see what the actual numbers are. Strategus is estimating a 3% gain in GDP. I've seen estimates as high as 4% for the quarter. But in general, the last several quarters have been at or slightly above trend. And that's really, again, been driven by consumer spending. But we've also seen business investment contribute positively to economic growth, although it's been a little volatile on a quarter-to-quarter basis, but it has been an added benefit along with consumer spending. So we do expect, given everything we've just talked about, that consumer spending will start to slow going forward. For most people, their savings are depleted and higher rates and inflation are kind of weighing on their outlook. So we do think that that will begin to slow down. Now, Strategus is showing a contraction in the fourth quarter and in the first quarter, so a two quarters of contraction or a mild recession. You know, I think we would agree with the magnitude of what they're looking here. The question is really the timing. Do we see it in the fourth quarter and first quarter, or do we see it in the first quarter and second quarter? You know, given the strength of the third quarter, we may be borrowing some growth from the third quarter, but that remains to be seen. But I think the trend that we're seeing here is that we could have slower growth going forward and or a mild recession, and then a moderate recovery after that. So with that, we'll talk about the Fed. They're certainly impacting everything we just talked about. So on the left-hand side of the page is the upper bound of the Fed funds rate. We're currently at 5.5%. The Fed has told us at their most recent meeting that they expect to raise rates one more time before the end of the year, so taking that upper bound to 5.75%. They've also told us that, and this is based on the average of all the participants at the Fed, that they would expect that they would cut rates twice next year. The market has a very different view on what the Fed will do, and we'll talk about that in a few slides. But I think the key here is that the Fed is close to ending their tightening, at least as it relates to interest rates. On the right-hand side of the page is the balance sheet, and we know that the Fed has had begun reducing the size of its balance sheet, and that continues. And we don't have any reason to believe that that won't continue going forward. So while they may be done tightening on the rate side, we do believe that they'll continue to reduce the size of their balance sheet. So there is some monetary tightening happening. One of the reasons we talk a lot about the Fed keeping rates higher for longer, one, we tend to believe what Fed Chair Powell is telling us, and also that he has very much been focused on the 1970s. So we're going to talk a little bit about that on page 12. And not to scare you, we're not expecting to have a 1970s event today, but I think it's a good illustration of what can happen if the Fed doesn't keep rates higher for longer. So here you've got CPI, the Consumer Price Index, going back to the late 60s. And we had that acceleration of inflation in the early 70s. On a year-over-year basis, CPI peaked just over 12%. The Fed was aggressively raising rates during that time period, and the economy went into a recession. And in response to the recession, the Fed aggressively cut interest rates to offset the recession. What happened is, as you see, inflation reaccelerated, reached a higher peak than the previous cycle. It was well over 14%. And by the time the Fed finished having to raise rates the second time, the Fed funds rate ended at 20%. Now, again, we're not predicting a 20% Fed funds rate or this type of reacceleration, but I think it's a great illustration of stop and go monetary policy and the risks of a reacceleration. When we talk about a reacceleration in inflation, we're not talking about something that dramatic. But I think this is why we firmly believe and differ a little bit from the market that the Fed is going to be very careful about cutting rates, even if the economy is slowing, even if we're in a recession, and even if the unemployment rate is rising. So real quickly on page 13, this is the market expectations for interest rates. So the green bars are the number of rate hikes or cuts that the market is expecting. And the green line is the implied Fed funds rate based on those increases or cuts. So if you look at the rest of this year, there's about a 50-50 chance based on market pricing that the Fed raises rates. So it's virtually a toss-up whether the Fed will increase interest rates one more time this year. Moving into next year, the market has at least three rate cuts coming next year. And, you know, this data was put together as of September 25th. We've seen that bounce between three and four rate cuts next year. So the market does expect that if the economy slows, the Fed is going to be much quicker to react than probably what our outlook is. So moving into the interest rate markets and fixed income, the actions taken by the Fed to fight inflation have ended what has been a very, very long bull market for the bond, for bonds. You know, what you've got here is the yield of the 2-year treasury on the left and the yield of the 10-year treasury on the right, going back to 1981, which was the end of that last cycle that we just talked about. And you can see how much interest rates have just really continued to move down during this time period. And remember, when yields fall, prices rise. So that's why we refer to this as a bond bull market. Obviously, with the Fed being so aggressive, we've seen interest rates move higher and this long-term trend towards lower rates ending. So the 2-year treasury is currently around 5.1% this morning, and the 10-year treasury is around 4.8% currently. So it's still the case that short-term rates are higher than long-term rates, and that's not a normal environment. Normally, you would expect that the longer you go out in maturity, you would expect more yield, not less. But with this inverted yield curve, you have short rates a little bit higher than long rates. That difference between the two has been narrowing of late as longer interest rates have moved higher, but it's still the case that there's more yield in the short end. And so when we look at that, our concern is not so much that interest rates are going to rise significantly from here, but that at some point rates will start to move lower. And so we're not concerned about interest rate risk, we're concerned about reinvestment risk. And that means when you want to put money into the market, what is the yield going to be as attractive 6 months from today, a year from today, as it is now? And there's also, you know, money market funds are yielding about 5.5%. And I know that's a very attractive thing to think about when there's a lot of uncertainty. But at some point, that's going to change as well. And so what we're looking at is extending the maturity of our fixed income assets to deal with that reinvestment risk. So if you have a fixed income allocation in your portfolio, you've probably noticed that we've extended the maturity of our bond ladder. So now we're buying bonds through 2028, and that's to lock in yields longer. Generally, we hold bonds to maturity, but in order to move to this, to move to the back end to that 2028 maturity, we did have to sell some bonds that mature over the next couple of months, 6 months, and in some cases, maybe even 1 year in order to buy those bonds at the back end of a bond ladder. So we're still buying high quality corporate bonds, and the portfolio has probably got an average yield to maturity of well above 5%. And we're locking that in, obviously, for longer. And we're still relatively conservative on our overall interest rate risk or duration risk. So we've moderately added yield for longer and a little bit more duration to that portfolio based on where we've been. Moving on to the equity market, I'll start on page 15. I'm sure a lot of you have heard or seen some of this, but it's been an interesting year in that the returns for the technology sector, and particularly firms that are attached somehow to artificial intelligence, have done significantly better than the rest of the market. And when you look at index returns, particularly here, we've got the S&P 500, the table at the top seven names, Apple, Alphabet, Amazon, Microsoft, Nvidia, Meta, and Tesla, they make up 25% of the S&P 500. This data, let me point out real quick, is also as of September 25th. So the absolute returns would be a little bit lower if I updated this today, but the relative relationships are the same. So through the 25th, the median return of those top seven companies was just over 45%. And on a valuation standpoint, the median PE or price to earnings ratio on a forward basis for those companies was 28 times. If you look at the remainder of the S&P 500 or the other 493 companies, they're 75% of the index. They had a median return of 4% and a forward PE of 14.8 times. So if you looked at just the S&P index on any given day, through last night, it's up 11.5% versus the 14.3 that we have here. But you would look at this and say, well, the index is up 14.3% and it's trading at 18 times next year's earnings. But in fact, the vast majority of the index is not up that much and has a much more attractive valuation. So it's creating some opportunities. At the bottom of the page, the graph, I think this is important to put in context that what we're seeing this year is a little bit unusual in the fact that these companies are driving the overall return of the market so strongly. So on a year-to-date basis, those seven companies are responsible for 79% of the index total return, and the other companies are responsible for 21%. But over longer time periods, it's much more balanced. So over the last 12 months, those companies are responsible for 35%, over 3 years, 30%, and over 5 years, 39%. So, you know, they're still going to have a very, because of their size, they are still going to impact returns going forward, but it's not as significant as what we're seeing this year. So the final page, we thought we hadn't talked a lot about some of our strategies in a while. So I thought we'd do a little bit of an overview of our income equity strategy, and particularly because we've been making some changes there and we'll continue to do so. So the top of the page has some characteristics of our income equity strategy. This is as of last quarter end because we haven't updated everything through quarter end. But you know, the goal of our income equity strategy is to build a portfolio that has above market dividend income and provides attractive dividend growth. Most companies will grow their dividend annually at a similar level as they grow their earnings. So if you look at the table up here, our portfolio currently yields 3.9%. That's the same yield where we are today. And our companies are expected to grow their earnings around 6.7% over the next 12 to 18 months. So we would expect to see the overall portfolio dividend grow in that same range, probably, you know, we'll call it 5 to 7%. The S&P 500, and the dividend yield is 1.4%. So we are getting significant additional dividend income relative to the index. The other thing we wanted to highlight is there are different ways to tackle a dividend strategy. You can buy companies that have a very high dividend, but maybe slower earnings growth. So that's some of the consumer staples companies who tend to have an above market dividend and maybe it grows low single digits every year. And then you can also buy companies that have dividend yields above market, but are growing faster. So at different times in the economic cycle, we may focus more on one or the other. Right now, we're relatively balanced between some companies that have a high dividend that's growing a little slower, some companies that have a little bit lower dividend yield currently, but are growing it significantly faster. Those might be growing their dividend high single digits. And in some cases, our companies are growing their dividend double digits on an annual basis. So that's sort of how we put it together. Now, due to market appreciation, we have some companies that don't really fit either one of those two things that I described. So their dividend yield is no longer significantly above the market and their dividend growth is low. So we want to upgrade those to companies that do meet our criteria. And at the end of September, we executed the first trade to do that. So we sold a very long-term holding, Procter & Gamble, and purchased a utility company, Entergy. So, you know, P&G is a solid company. It's been a great portfolio performer over the years, but its dividend yield had fallen to about 2.3, 2.4%. And its annual dividend growth was in the low single digits. So it really didn't meet that criteria. Entergy, we bought a utility yielding 4.8% currently. Its annual dividend growth has been in the mid to high single digits. And the added bonus is, as you know, with interest rates rising, the utility sector has underperformed pretty dramatically this year. So we were able to buy a company at a much lower price than we think is warranted, especially given the defensive nature of the utility sector. We expect to do a few more of these trades over the next several weeks, and we'll let you know as those come to the portfolio. But overall, the idea is to enhance the overall dividend, improve where we can the annual dividend growth, and then also to be able to take advantage of the dislocation in the market where defensive sectors and non-tech related sectors look much cheaper than we think they should at this point in the economic cycle. So I know I've gone long again. I'll stop here and turn it back over to Michael.
All right. Thanks, Jean. That was great and informative. That's fine. And we are right up against the ending point here. We did receive a number of questions during the call, ranging from the impact that higher interest rates and money market fund yields have on investing in the stock market, the substitution effect there, the impacts of student loan repayments resuming, as well as what we expect the upcoming, or I guess we're already in the election cycle,
unfortunately,
for 2024, and what impacts we can expect that to have on the economy and on the stock markets. And one final in here on the line is what do we think the effects of the failure of kind of the traditional retail businesses are going to have on the economy? So we will answer all that and more.
Yes.
And in a follow-up response to this, we will have that out in the coming week or so, and we will send those questions and responses out to everybody who's on the call here, so everyone can have the benefit of Gene's great wisdom.
And hopefully I've hit on some of those themes, and particularly reinvestment risk and in money market funds and things like that. But yes, we will get them all out there. Great questions. I promise one of these days I'll talk less and answer more questions.
Well, fantastic. Well, with that, we will let everybody go. And thanks again, everybody, for joining us. And we will hopefully see everybody soon. And like I said, we'll get those questions out as soon as we possibly can. So thanks, everybody. Have a great day.
Thank you.